2010, John McNamara. The game, Philadelphia Phillies 11, Washington Nationals 1 at Nationals Park, Washington, D.C. Attendance, 41,290. On Monday, April 5th, 2010, the weather, spectacular, 70s and sunny. Hall of Famers, Phillies pitcher Roy Halladay and Nationals catcher Ivan Rodriguez. Future Hall of Famers, maybe Philly second baseman Chase Utley. He'll be eligible in 2024. Game highlights. This marked the National League and Philadelphia Phillies debut of pitcher Roy Halladay. During 11 seasons north of the border, Halladay dominated the American League. But after approving an off-season trade from Toronto because he wanted to play for a contender, the 33-year-old delivered notice on opening day that his best was yet to come. He stymied the Nationals, allowing only one run in 7 innings. The following month, Halladay would pitch a perfect game at Florida. In October, in the first playoff game of his brilliant career, Halladay pitched only the second postseason no-hitter in baseball history. Roundy was the first. See Chapter 1970. And he became only the fifth pitcher to win the Cy Young Award in both leagues. On this opening day, things stayed interesting for a while. Just minutes after accepting his 2009 National League Silver Slugger and Gold Glove Awards, third baseman Ryan Zimmerman doubled home the Nationals' only run of the day. Starter John Lannon kept pace with Halladay for 3 innings, taking a 1-0 lead into the fourth. That's when the Phillies lit him up, sending 11 men to the plate and scoring 5, including a 2-run homer by Ryan Howard, the National League's 2005 Rookie of the Year and 2006 MVP. Even Halladay got in on the fun with an RBI single. A grand slam by Placido Polanco in the 7th sent most remaining home team fans to the exits, leaving behind the Phillies faithful to celebrate in Nationals Park. It was a common scene in Washington during Philadelphia's 5-year stretch of NL East division dominance from 2007 to 2011, when tickets were tight in South Philly and plentiful in D.C., just a 2-hour train ride away. The story. Over the past 40-plus years, I've been fortunate to stay in touch with so many sports media types I grew up with in the 70s. One was Beth Huffman, who in 1980 became the first female sports editor of Notre Dame's student newspaper, The Observer. She went on to work in college athletics and later as a sports writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer before transitioning to corporate marketing and communications in the legal profession. This opening day, she'd taken Amtrak to Washington to see her Phillies and experience Nationals Park for the first time. Another sports writer friend from the 70s was John McNamara. It was tough to connect with John over the years, even at games, because he was working. For 40 years, from high school through college and beyond, John stuck with his passions, sports and writing. We made plans, though, to connect on this opening day. With President Obama scheduled for first pitch duties, Beth and I arrived early to beat the security crunch. I excused myself from pregame social activity, told Beth I'd meet her at the seats, and journeyed to the upper deck to see John. He came down from the press box high atop Nationals Park for our rendezvous on the concourse. It was the first time we'd seen each other in years. The high five and hugs were so genuine. Decades melted. As we shared life experiences, we gazed down as fans filed into one of baseball's newest shrines, a spectacular aerial view I had not yet experienced during the ballpark's first 2 seasons. "Did you think we'd live long enough to see this?" John asked sincerely. "I had my doubts," I answered back. "We all did," he added soberly, "of our long wait for baseball's return. But look at this. Look at us," he added with a smirkish grin. Little did we know at the time, I was standing with a man who would be recognized more than 8 years later on the cover of Time Magazine's 2018 Person of the Year issue. The storied publication honored The Guardians and the War on Truth. More than 50 journalists were murdered in 2018. John was one of 5 shot and killed on June 28, 2018, in his newsroom at the Capital Gazette. In the weeks that followed this senseless assault in Annapolis, it seemed less painful to dwell on the past with a smile than to try to make sense of the present. John and I were a year apart in high school, but we had so much in common. DC sports junkies to the core, trying to figure out if maybe someday someone might actually pay us to do what we love, write or talk about sports. During the 1977-78 school year, we were the sports section of our high school paper. Our passion that spring was the basketball team general manager Bob Ferry had assembled, the Washington Bullets, with players like Kevin Greavy, Phil Chenier, Wes Unseld, Elvin Hayes, and Bobby Dandridge. When the Bullets defeated the Supersonics in Seattle for an unlikely NBA title, the opera was over, Coach Dick Motta's figurative fat lady sang, and nowhere on the planet were there two teenagers more excited than me and John. I went off to Notre Dame. He stayed and became editor of the high school paper, and then a year later, John was off to the University of Maryland. During those summers, we would play keg softball on Sunday afternoons near his house in Bethesda. The Barwood cab drivers with whom we played had only one strict rule. If you knocked over someone's beer in the field, you were automatically out. I remember fondly a basketball showdown between our universities in January 1981. I'm not sure if ND's student radio station, WSND, had any listeners, but it did have a small travel budget, and they paid my way for a weekend trip home to call this game. We arranged to have the beat reporter from the Maryland student newspaper, sophomore John McNamara, as the on-air halftime guest. For a 19-year-old to have such a prestigious assignment was almost unheard of in college journalism at the time, but John had earned it. Even though Notre Dame's visiting student radio crew was exiled to the rafters of Cole Fieldhouse, just to be in the building working this nationally televised contest between two of the country's top-ranked teams had us pinching ourselves. Are we really here? Is this really happening? We were like kids in a candy store. John was in his element, as he would be so many more times over the next 30-plus years. He made the trek upstairs that afternoon from what I assume was a comfy courtside seat assigned to the Diamondback, donned the WSND headset, and we started talking like the world was listening. It was a classic college basketball matchup with Lefty Driesell versus Digger Phelps, plus some of the greatest players in each school's history: Albert King, Kelly Trapuka, Ernie Graham, Orlando Woolridge, Buck Williams, John Paxson, Greg Manning, and Tracy Jackson, all in the same game. John could have talked Terps hoops for hours. We were almost disappointed that the second half had to be played. Little did we know at the time, this halftime radio guest thing at a Maryland basketball game was something John would do with the Terrapins' legendary broadcaster Johnny Holiday dozens more times in the decades that followed. John was immensely trusted and respected by the coaches. His reporting was fair and honest. John's tenure included Maryland's 2002 national championship. Hall of Fame coach Gary Williams was a guest of honor at John's memorial service on the College Park campus and wrote the foreword for John's last book, The Capital of Basketball. I dug into the Diamondback archives and read John's pregame and postgame coverage of that 1981 game. Not surprisingly, it was polished, well-written, and concise. Absent were the snide or unnecessarily clever remarks that frequently flow from the fingers of student journalists while they're still learning how to report, and not opine. And from the tributes following his passing written by many of his mentees over the years, it seems that quality served him well. His lack of ego made him a marvelous reporter and probably kept him from being a columnist. Heaven knows John always had an opinion, but I can't imagine he'd be very comfortable knowing large numbers of people were waking up every morning wondering what it was. His writings were almost always about someone or something else, not about his view of the world. If you had scrolled through his Facebook feed during his final years, you would have found quotes by someone else, John applauding another person's achievement, especially those with a connection to DC sports, or sharing somebody else's excellent work. One such share is rather chilling in retrospect. In 2017, John shared a Washington Post piece on gun violence, which he described as, quote, a sobering look at the gun problem in the D.C. area, told by following the trail of one gun. A good argument for greater gun control if there ever was one, unquote. You'd almost never see John show off his own work. A rare exception came a month before he was killed when he shared his piece on the aforementioned Bob Ferry on the 40th anniversary of that bullet's title. In August 2016, Washington Senators legend Frank Hondo Howard was finally inducted into the Nationals Park Ring of Honor. John was one of the few people I knew who would truly appreciate the significance of honoring a man who last played in D.C. in 1971. Like me, John had saved his ticket stub from that awful September night when Hondo hit the last home run ever by a Washington Senator. I invited John to join me at Nats Park the night of Howard's induction. He had other plans, but his prompt response was concise, well-written, and included a pointed retort. Hondo should have been in there years ago. What gives? Vintage John. Since John couldn't join me, another D.C. baseball loyalist, Notre Dame classmate Tom Jackman, or TJ, shared that nostalgic Hondo night in 2016. Like John, he had been a friend since the 70s, was a diehard fan of the Washington Senators, loved journalism, and stuck with it for life. When I was writing about Notre Dame sports, TJ was more of a news junkie, skills he refined at the New York Times and Kansas City Star before landing at the Washington Post in 1998, where he would become a Pulitzer Prize-winning crime reporter. John and TJ were similar men from different parts of my life who never met. Eerie irony. The Post assigned TJ to cover John's murder. A couple of months later, a small group of John's friends and family gathered one quiet Saturday morning outside the center field gate of Nationals Park. His widow, Andrea Chambly, had somehow convinced the Lerner family to allow her to carry out a wish John had whimsically expressed a year earlier, to have his ashes placed at Nationals Park. The request was not unique, but the approval was. A team representative escorted us to the seats just above the outfield wall where Andrea shared beautiful words about John's life. "I never thought they'd let us do this," she said. "They allowed it not because of how John died, but because of how he lived. He was a sports writer." Andrea was pleased with the spot the Nationals had selected, the flower box atop the left field wall. "This is the perfect spot. John told us to watch out for Juan Soto," she said of the team's then 19-year-old rookie left fielder who made his major league debut just 6 weeks before the shooting. "He said Soto is going to be the next Bryce Harper." A year later, Soto and the Nationals were in the midst of their storybook run through the postseason. I was at Game 4 of the National League Championship Series, coincidentally with TJ. The Nationals led the best-of-seven series 3-0, and were hoping for a sweep and a trip to the World Series. I wanted to capture the night with a very specific photo. During the top of the third inning, I wandered out to sections 105-106, where Andrea had placed John's ashes. I explained the situation to the usher and the access I needed.
"I'm sorry," he responded dutifully, "but without a ticket for this section, I can't let you do that."
He then immediately turned the other way, as if to say, "Go for it." I took my cue and scurried down the steps, squatting at the front of the section. I briefly explained my mission to the fan in the front row aisle seat, who could not have been more gracious. Tap, tap. Mission accomplished. A photo of the begonias in the foreground and a very focused Juan Soto right behind. On the way back to my seat, I made eye contact with that usher. I just smiled and nodded. So did he. About 2 hours later, Nationals reliever Daniel Hudson closed things out with a 1-2-3 inning, including a flyout to Soto. The ballpark erupted. Players and fans were jumping, hugging, screaming, crying. For the first time in 86 years, a Washington baseball team was going to the World Series. As the Nationals players slipped on their National League champions' caps and the grounds crew hastily assembled a stage near second base for the postgame ceremonies, a euphoric Jackman turned and said, "This is all I need. Whatever happens from here on, happens." As the celebration continued, I was haunted by John's words from opening day, 2010. Did you think we'd live long enough to see this? I'm sorry you didn't, my friend, but good to know you're keeping an eye on all of us. For the box score, play-by-play, our ticket stubs from that awful night in 1971, plus the picture of the begonias, visit openingday5050.com.